reality in nature, but this is something for future, yeah? Einstein never got far with it, so not to mention what I got. But today I will speak then about the quantum measurement problem, and these are works, with my two collaborators, Arman Alafelian from Yerevan. He is about 35 years old. He was a postdoc in Amsterdam for several years, and also a postdoc in Saclay, together with Roger Balian. And by this mutual connection, we got onto this problem. Actually, the first paper we have about this, what I will speak about today, was 2003. And then we have all kinds of contributions going up. And these were mostly for the proceedings of the meeting in Sweden that Chris knows very well. I have several there and also some other places. And we are now finishing a review paper. Actually, I have it here. You can see it's about 1. So much centimeters, I'll say half an inch or so. So let's see where this is going. I will first recall the statistical interpretation of quantum mechanics, because from that interpretation I will try to view what I do later. Of course, you don't have to say that after my short introduction this is your view, but we can discuss then later other approaches. I will shortly recall what textbooks say about it, but here that's not so. Everybody knows this, I suppose, but sometimes people want to be reminded. Then, of course, this is a problem with, it's a mind problem with mind fields everywhere, and there are questions out there and paradoxes, and the big question I will come to. Then I come to the system I want to discuss. So I will measure a system, which we call S, by an apparatus, which we call A. And to keep things as simple as possible, the system will just be a spin 1/2. And we are going to measure the Z components of this spin. And it can be plus or minus 1 in certain units. This apparatus will then do the measurement. So it will then be a magnet, which will start out in a paramagnetic state and end up in the plus, in the up or down ferromagnetic state. And this will then be coupled to the spin, whether that is up or down. And this, of course, this magnet has to be coupled to a bath, because if you just have a magnet, it will already be coupled by a bath. So also if you use this magnet as an apparatus. Then, having defined all of this, we can look at the dynamics of the measurement. So actually, we're going to do kind of the things that people do in the lab. In the lab, they have some apparatus, and they turn it on and then see what's going on. At a certain moment, the measurement is done, and we're going to see all of that in the dynamics of the system defined here. So there will be a collapse basis. And it will be a certain basis. So what is this? What is, how is this selected? What happens to the Schrödinger cat terms? We know that they should not be there. And we'll see what they do. Then after that, you, on a longer time scale, you get a registration. And it starts to look a bit like classical, although it only looks, it's not really classical. Then when the measurement is done, we can look after the measurement and Born rule. And we can look at what this teaches us about the quantum measurement problem. So that's a setup. So statistical interpretation of quantum mechanics. Probably, I hope that this is known, but it's here. Let me just say that Einstein worked on the statistical interpretation in 2 periods of his life, including the last months of his life. It was a paper of 1955. But he was not the first to come up with this. I think there's a book in the 30s already where it is mentioned. And this is not a surprise, because all these people that started to do the great masters of quantum physics, they were all very good in thermodynamics. It was the thing they learned. They couldn't learn quantum physics. It did not exist yet. They learned a lot about what was known then, which was statistical physics and, of course, also electromagnetism. So let's see what this is going to do. So we have a density matrix as usual. And, but this density matrix describes an ensemble of identically prepared systems. So if you have a pure state, then this, you have only one term here. And that's a limiting case where all the other terms go to zero. But it will keep the same meaning, which means also describes an ensemble of identically prepared systems. And there's no special role for a pure state in this interpretation. So you have an ensemble of these systems. Now, this ensemble can be real. You can have many particles, like a bundle of particles in the Large Hadron Collider. So you have all these particles together going around there, and that would be one ensemble together. It can also be one ion, so now you have one particle only, but you put it in a trap and in a photon field, and the photon will excite the ion, and the ion will emit some light and go back to the ground state, and then it can be again excited by the photon field. So now you have repeated excitation, which brings you your ensemble. And then the ensemble can also be virtual, as you can have in classical statistical physics. Or for those who are interested in cosmology, you like to do averages in cosmology, at least in your theory, but it's not easy to imagine what will be another universe. We have one, so your ensemble is virtual. So in this interpretation, quantum mechanics is no more, no less, than a tool for calculating averages from the density matrix. So the average of A, it would be in the textbooks, it would be this expectation value of A in the state psi, but if you have a density matrix, it would be the trace. And then quantum mechanics is a theory about what we can measure, and not about what is. So this is the old problem of Einstein and Bohr of epistemology versus ontology. So we like this, but this is not in our hands today. It's not in the talk of today. Maybe for future, or maybe only for dreams. That will be answered later. So quantum measurement theory then describes an ensemble of measurements of an ensemble of systems, and you will get then some statistics of those outcomes. So in textbooks, of course, life is much shorter. You see much smaller, much less information on this slide. So you say you have a wave function, it's some superposition of other basis states. And if you do a measurement, you will measure one of these basis states. It's called collapse of the wave function. You only measure one. And it goes with the Born probabilities. So this pure state ends up in the mixed state. And you can also say you have a projection on this eigenstate, and you get this stuff. But in particular, there will be no Schrödinger cat terms. This is some postulate of the textbooks. So there will be no IJ terms after the measurement. So somehow these off-diagonal terms go to zero. Well, that's good enough for textbooks, because the students have to learn so much more than only how this is going, and they find it difficult enough. But there have been lots of people who didn't find it so pleasant, this situation. Einstein, Bohr, De Bruyne, von Neumann, Wigner, and also of the later part of the 20th century, I would like to mention Bohm and Bell, Balian van Kampen. These are well known in America. Balian is my coworker, but he also started to work on this already in the 70s, 80s, and van Kampen was one of my teachers in Utrecht who also had to work on that in the 50s and in the late 80s. Now, the whole problem is, of course, that this collapse going from a possibly pure state to an always mixed state is non-unitary. And then you can ask yourself another problem. Suppose that I would describe a small part of my apparatus. So, say a small piece, how would I do this? Well, probably I would just do quantum mechanics. But if you do a small part by quantum mechanics, then why not the whole apparatus? And then why not the dynamics of this apparatus? In other words, is the whole quantum measurement process not somehow encoded in quantum mechanics? And this I will answer with yes in this talk. Now, there are other problems for theorists. There's a preferred basis paradox. because we will get a reduction on some basis, but what is that basis? And who will determine this for me? Well, the literature about this is quite broad and informative. Although it has somehow emerged, nevertheless, in the later decades. But you can ask yourself more, when does this collapse happen? And maybe it has a finite time. Why should it be? If I have a real apparatus, then how can I imagine that in this real apparatus, something would happen with zero time? That would be strange. So it will have a finite time, but what is this time and so on? Not a related question is what happens to these Schrodinger cat states. But the biggest question of them all is what's called the quantum measurement problem, and also the title of this talk. It's a question, we know the quantum mechanics is statistical theory, but in experiments we see individual outcomes. So how is this possible? Well, of course, we know this from doing the experiments. You always get one outcome in one experiment, you never get outcomes with certain probabilities. You always get this or that. And if you repeat, you get your probabilities. So this is the old, one of the deepest questions that has always been hanging around in this field. And the question is then whether it is solvable within quantum mechanics or not. And many people have given up. They have started to look outside quantum mechanics, or even given up the hope completely. But I will try to answer this in my way then, within quantum mechanics. So that is where this talk is going. Well, here I have a set of requirements for quantum measurement models. And just to give you an idea of where I want to go, first of all, I think it's good to look at what experimentalists do. If you want to describe some physics, then try to get what these people doing it in the lab, how they try to do. You can always learn, and if you do not learn much, then you continue with your own stuff. So there should be an unbiased and robust registration by this pointer. That is, of course, obvious. The apparatus should initially be in a metastable state and go to a stable state induced by the measurement. Because in that case, you can amplify the small quantum signal by the big apparatus. And this apparatus can then not be in a pure state because it's a very big apparatus and you cannot prepare that in a pure state. The apparatus should include a bath because it goes from a metastable state to a stable state. So it has to dump free energy released by this pointer variable. We will see that will be the magnetization of my magnet. We'll see that. But this free energy has to go somewhere. So you certainly need this bath. Well, then it's nice if the problem, if your model is solvable and you can find those characteristic timescales that have to do with reduction and registration and maybe more. And of course, in the final state, there should be no Schrodinger cat terms and things that go with them. And of course, you should satisfy the Born rule, at least for ideal measurements. And there should be correlations between the system and the apparatus because you need a you want to do a measurement, so it should, you can only look at the apparatus, so it must be correlated, else you learn nothing. And it would, of course, be nice if it is solvable, but also can be solved if you allow non-idealities, because that will be the typical application of any measurement theory. Actually, as far as I know, we always speak about ideal measurements. But the only ideal measurement that was done in the lab was done about 5 years ago or so in the group of Moy in Delft. Would you know another application, Chris? Ideal measurement carried out in the lab. Because, so imagine. We can discuss later, but this is what Moore told me when he was writing this paper. And that's only recently. And it's quite amazing that what we teach all the people is not that easy to do in the lab. In the lab, typically, you do other things which are close to it, but not exactly that over. So here's my model. So I have a system S, and it's a spin 1/2 that I want to measure. And I want to do an ideal measurement. So I take its own Hamiltonian equal to 0. So if I do not do a measurement, then this spin is doing nothing. That's very handy, because then I'm sure that it does not mix up with the measurement I want to do. So I will measure it by an apparatus, and this will be a magnet plus a bath. So A, the apparatus, is M plus B, magnet plus bath. So this magnet, it will have N spins 1/2, and I call them sigma. So the tested spin is called S, and these apparatus spins are called sigma. And the important variable, the pointer variable of my problem, will be the magnetization in the Z direction. So it's just this average of these spin operators. And this I call M, and I do not write the Z here just to save space. And then this bath will be a phonon bath of harmonic oscillators. So here is my system S. Here is my apparatus consisting of magnet and bath. And then, of course, I have these connections between the two. So I have a, so this has its, so the total Hamiltonian is this for this system and for the apparatus, and then this coupling between system and apparatus. So the system has a Hamiltonian 0, as I said already, and the system apparatus coupling here, it will be a spin-spin coupling between the spin that I want to measure, the S, SZ, and the spins of the magnet, the sigma zs, and then it's coupled to all of them with a strength g. And this sum I can write in terms of this magnetization as n times this magnetization. So that is the interaction that is going to do the measurement. Before the measurement, this g will be 0. And then I turn it on at time 0, I let it evolve, and after, when everything is done, I can take it back to 0. So then I have this, the magnet itself. Here I have to choose some model, and I take a model that's solvable. So I take interactions which would be the square in this magnetization and to the fourth power. And if you write this out in terms of these spin operators, you have here a two-particle interaction and here a four-particle interaction. So if you had only this term, it would be called Curie-Weiss model for the ferromagnet. It is the magnetic analog of the van der Waals transition, and Amsterdam, we have there this van der Waals, van der Waals lab, is now van der Waals-Zeeman lab. So, and then I also take this term into account, because if I have this, this fourth-order coupling, then I can have a first-order phase transition. And we also study the second-order phase transition, but I do not find that so convincing. So in the talk, I will only speak about the first-order phase transition. So, and that comes when this J4 is strong enough. And actually, if you do it that, you can go to the extreme case to keep the formulas a bit shorter and put this J2 equal to 0, and only keep this fourth order term. But if you wish, you can imagine that this second order term is also there. Then this whole stuff is coupled to a bath, and the bath will just be standard harmonic oscillators. So it's a whole sum, because for each spin of the magnet, there would be n of those spins. And then for each of its components, x, y, z, I have a set of oscillators labeled by k, and there's a whole sum of them. So this is democracy for all these components of all these spins. They all couple to their own harmonic oscillator bath. And this interaction between the magnet and the bath is then a sum of each of these spin components with the bath operator. And it's all there. And these bath operators, they themselves are a sum over this last index of many, many harmonic oscillators. And but this bath, we know from these approaches, that this bath is characterized by its correlator. And this is the only thing you have to know. It's this function k of t, and that defines the whole bath in the end. And here I will take what's called the quasi-ohmic bath. But if you have this, and then because it's all these things are independent for the rest, then you can solve the whole problem. And in particular, if you take a recoupling between the magnet and the bar, so this gamma, this prefactor here in the coupling between the magnet and the bar, if that is small, then you can work to lowest order in this coupling, which also makes life a bit easier, so that's what we will do. So we have this initial density matrix of the full system. So this is the D is this complete system. This is for my tested spin, and this is for the apparatus. And this tested spin, it can be anything. I don't know. This is exactly what I want to measure. So these are numbers that I want to know, and they are not correlated with the apparatus. Then we have this apparatus. We will have it start in a mixed state. And the mixed state will be a product state of the magnet and the bar. So this describes the magnet, and this the bar. And again, at time zero, they know nothing about each other. So this magnet, it has n of these spins 1/2. And we choose that this starts as a paramagnet, which means a fully mixed state. And that means that this part of the magnet is a product for each of these independent spins, and all of them are completely disordered. They have the unit matrix and a normalization factor 1/2. Which means that they have probability 1/2 to be up and probability 1/2 to be down, and they are not correlated to anything. And the bath, well, in thermal physics, you always take the bath at some Gibbs state at some temperature beta, which is 1 over T. This is just standard. So now look, this state can be mixed or not. For instance, these off-diagonal terms can be 0, and that can be 0. It can be 3 terms. 0 here, I would have a 1 here. That is one special case of a pure initial state. That is possible. But this magnet will have a mixed initial state, and this bath also. And the choice for this is because we think that that is what it looks like in the experiments. In the experiment, if you know, of course you know, that experimentalists, when they start the measurements, well, typically Monday morning, 9 o'clock, they turn everything on and they have coffee. And they just have coffee to let everything get to equilibrium, to a good, stable state, and from then on they will do the measurements. And it's something like this here. We want that this initial state is some state, which actually we will prepare at high temperatures. So at very high temperatures, your magnet will be in a paramagnetic state, and it will be completely disordered there. Then at time zero, we put this to the temperature T of the bath. We just put it in. And this bath by itself will also be completely a mixed state, Gibbs state. And this is the theoretical way that we describe this, what the experimentalists do with their thermalization of the initial state and the stabilization of the initial state. So now we're going to do, now we are in business because we have now defined the whole setup, and we must now solve the problem and see what we learned from this. And I will point out a few steps which are seen in this solution. So the first question is, what selects the collapse phases? And of course, on physical grounds, you are already feeling that this should be the interaction Hamiltonian. There's nothing else in the model that could do it. And it's also clear that this is exactly what's going on. So if you describe theory of quantum measurements and you do not specify your apparatus, and you do not specify the interaction of your apparatus with your system, then you have a problem about this collapse basis. But if you just take a model to describe a certain situation, it will be in your model. To see this, you can just take the von Neumann equation for the full density matrix of the system plus the apparatus and trace out the apparatus. Well, that's easy. Here is your von Neumann equation. This is your complete density matrix. And here are the four components regarding to the tested spin. This is the up-up component for the tested spin, and you have those four components. And if you, we have now chosen the model so nice that these four sectors, all of them here, each they decouple from each other. So that is nice. We get four equations, and we can study them one by one. So we are going to trace out this thing and see what comes. So if I would take the trace of this thing itself, I would get, if I would take the trace of this element, so the spin is here specified, the tested spin, but this is an operator in the apparatus Hilbert space. If I trace out this apparatus, I just get the spin components at a later time. So let me write this down. So my R ij of at time t, it will be the trace over the apparatus, and that is the magnet plus the bath, of this curly d ij at time t. This is just the definition of my density matrix for the tested spin at later times. And if I now take this trace here on the left, so on the left I get the time derivative of this element for the tested spin. And on the right, I have the trace of a commutator, and that's very nice because many terms drop out. And that keeps me with simple terms. And the only term that does not drop out in this setup is the term I have here, this interaction Hamiltonian. Because I have this spin here, and I do not trace over this spin. So what comes out there, if I really look, if I have this ij element, for instance, this element, it turns out I get those eigenvalues for I and j. So here I is 1, Si would be plus 1. Here j is minus 1, and Sj would be minus 1. I would have 1 minus minus 1. So I get 2 here. That's not 0. And I get something which is then the rest of the story. So what I see here, if I take this, this up-down element, I do not get 0. But if I would take the diagonal element, I would have this S would be 1 in this case, but this Sj would also be 1, so they would cancel. So that is nice. The diagonal elements are conserved. And they are completely conserved in the whole process. And that is very nice, because that is Born rule. At time t, these diagonal elements will be just conserved. And this is the Born rule, so that comes easily out of this model. And the non-diagonal terms, that will be a longer story, and they will evolve in time, and I will show that they will disappear. And these are the Schrödinger cat terms. Of course, we like to see that these terms disappear from the story in the course of time. So these Schrödinger cat terms. Well, at very short times, the problem is rather simple, because I do not have to take care of the spin-spin couplings in the magnets. I can. It turns out you can forget them, and that makes life very easy, because then the spins of the magnet are no longer coupled to each other, or not yet coupled, not yet effectively coupled to each other. They only couple to this tested spin, and the spin will work as a magnetic field. So in the up-up sector, it will be plus G, and in the down-down, this field, let me put it this way, the field that they will feel is G times Si, where Si is plus or minus 1, that's the spin I'm measuring. And these spins of the apparatus will feel either of these two values. So in this upper part, it will feel the plus value, and in the lower part, it will. So here's the density matrix of one of those spins of the apparatus at time t. It started out from this. I had this initial state. It was 1/2 1 0, 1. And now these elements start to evolve with these exponentials. So this one goes with the plus IGT and this with the minus. And then if you look a bit longer time, you also get an effect from the bath. It is here, it has a t to the 4 term. But this term by itself is just the Larmor precession of the spins of the magnet in the field of the tested spin. And this will be a damping. And if you look where this k comes from, it comes from the bath, but then only from the zero-point fluctuations. Or at least at zero temperature, you still have this full effect. And at finer temperature, the temperature has a small effect on it. A really small effect. So basically, this is a damping by the zero-point fluctuations of the bath. Now, if you want to know the Schrödinger cat term, that is this element. So you have to trace over the apparatus. So you have to trace over this object. So you get a cosine here by taking the trace, which means summing these terms. The cosine is here, and you get this term. And then this apparatus has n of those spins, capital N. So you get the cosine to the n power, and you get this damping also with the factor n. And this cosine, it's of course a cosine, so it is repetitive. But at short times, it decays very quickly. It decays with a Gaussian, and this was a fourth order term. So at short times, you have just a defacing of this defacing going on. You have all these spins of the magnet, and there are very many, and they just let this term decay at short time. And this term will, when it becomes relevant, it depends on all these parameters when it comes in. But this is a t to the 4 term, so this term will start to work first, and this one will come later. And this will lead then to a decoherence. So if I only look at this term, this would go to 0 very quickly, but it could come back later. I could have those recurrences. And these I don't want, because that would mean that the Schrödinger cat terms come to life again. They should just disappear. And they will disappear if this term sets in before this thing returns. And so this term, this cosine to the n, is a defacing in the magnet alone. And this could, in principle, come back, as you can see from the shape of the cosine. But this term here is a decoherence by the zero-point fluctuations of the bath. So when this starts to work, then everything will be lost to the bath, and nothing will come back. So then you're done with your Schrödinger cat terms, which was one of the tasks to show for a credible measurement model. So these recurrences of this cosine, they are wiped out by the zero-point fluctuations of the bath, which is coded in this factor k there. Now you see here factor k coming from the bath alone. Gamma is the coupling between the bath and the magnets, and g is the coupling between the magnets and the tested spin. So everybody is here. Here you go from the spin to the magnet, and here you go from the magnet to the bath. It all comes in there. So these recurrences, they are eliminated. And they could even be eliminated in another model. Namely, if all these g's were not exactly the same, then I would not have the power here of the same cosine. I would have a product of all these different cosines. And I would also never see back these peaks at later times. But this is not the only thing that happens. There's also, in the process where this happens, there's also a creation of multi-particle correlations. And this is very much the same as you have in statistical physics. You build up multi-particle correlations, and these are very weak, and you do not really see them. And you're certainly not going to measure them. But they are there, and the fact that these terms can disappear comes through the physical fact that you build up multi-particle correlations. So you can look at the tested spin, the x component minus I times the y component, and the kth power of this magnetization operator. And this will develop a time dependence. At time zero, this will be zero because they were uncorrelated. And at later times, you get some buildup. And if you have k of these powers here, you get t to the k times some exponential there. And this will decay very, this will first of all, it's zero at time zero, also zero at time infinity, because this goes to zero. And if this is not enough zero, I also have this term to kill it. But then this reduction time is very small, because it would be one, if you look a bit here, you can see that this reduction time, this tau reduction, is of order 1 over square root of n. So this is a very small time for a big apparatus. This exponential will kill the whole stuff very quickly. And I have here only t to the k, so this would be of the order of 1 over square root n for each t. So this whole stuff will be very small, 1 over square root n to the k for the k particle correlation. So I do build up more and more particle correlations, because for higher k, at a later time, I do get those correlations, but they are all very small, and I do not really see them. This is going on something in the dynamics of the measurement, which makes the whole system physically consistent. So basically, all this information is going away from the tested spin itself to the whole apparatus, and that is how this can go on. So these Schrödinger cat terms, they die out by themselves, unhappily, but they do. So then we go to the registration of the measurement. So now we have to look at the diagonal elements of this full density matrix. And we work, as I said, in this approximation that we only consider second order in the coupling between the magnet and the bath. So to make this simple, I can make an analogy to classical measurements. Although this is not exactly what's going on, but it's a nice analogy. So the magnetization M, in a classical setup, I would have a classical Ising spin, S set would be plus or minus 1. And this magnet would have, also these magnet spins would be plus or minus 1, as you would have a problem in classical statistical physics. And then we would like to measure a classical spin with a classical apparatus and a bath consisting of these such spins and then some bath coupled to it. And the classical Hamiltonian would be, well, here is my coupling between the system and the bath, between the tested system and the magnets. And this would be the Hamiltonian of the magnet itself. And this M here, it would be, I put a bar below it because it's not a quantum operator, but now the numerical average of these spins, which are plus or minus 1. And then you would think of a dynamics. Just let's think of the average value for the magnetization. And you can then think about how to do it, and this has been done long before. For instance, Suzuki and Trotto did this. Probably Glauber certainly did it. So you have some dynamics. And then this dynamics would be zero if M satisfies your mean field equation. So the mean field equation is, you can read off from here, but I can write it down also. So that would be M is tangent hyperbolic of beta times your field. And your field here would be G times M plus J times M cubed in this case, where I measure the spin if the case that the spin which is measured is up. And in general, there would be an S set here. If it is down, then it would pick up a minus sign there. And this this dynamics is just a stable minimum of the free energy. So here, the free energy in this mean field type of model, it is just the Hamiltonian that I have here. It was already there, the same Hamiltonian. And there would be an entropy term coming from standard terms from the n factorial which comes in there. So you would just have your classical Curie-Weiss model. So here is again the spin-spin coupling in the apparatus. Here's the coupling between the tested spin and the magnet. And here's the entropy term. And now you can look at this. So let's first forget about this coupling. We are just look at the magnet itself now. And at high temperatures, this free energy looks like this. So you have a minimum at M is zero. So at high temperatures, the paramagnet is your thermodynamically stable state. And this we know, if you have a magnet, you heat it enough, then you lose your magnetism. And if the temperature is lower, then you know that there are stable ferromagnetic states, one here with plus and one with minus. They will not exactly be at plus one or minus one, but they will be rather close to it. But this has a small turn up here. But this difference is not so important for this talk. So now we can do the measurement. As I said, we can start at time zero in this paramagnetic state. If I do not do a measurement, it would stay there because it would not like to go over this barrier because there's a factor n in front of this whole story. So the barrier would be of order n. It would not like to go there in reasonable time. So it just sits there. And then I turn on the apparatus, which means I turn on the coupling with the tested spin. And this tested spin, it's this coupling H of this coupling G. When I turn it on, I have a field which is G times SZ, so it is G times plus or minus 1. So let's consider the case where it is plus 1. Then this field acts as a linear term on this free energy, so I have now to combine that with the previous plot, and I get this one. And now you see that if this is the case, then the initial state which was here, it likes to run down the hill and end up there. And here is the energy. And this is exactly what's going to do the measurement. So then, of course, I end up in a state of high energy, and I start in a state of high energy, end up in a state of low energy. So you need a bath to dump this free energy. So, and that will be the procedure. I will turn off this coupling. I turn it on at time zero. And then when the system is there, the magnet, and it has arrived there, I can wait a while, and then I can turn it off. So now it sits here. So then I turn off this field. So I go back to this situation we had here. And I will end up here in this case. And in principle, I could now jump to this case, but that will take an enormous time, which means that in practice it will not happen. I will just remain and sitting there. And then I can read off the result of the of the measurements. And so this was a case where the field was positive. So then it will end up here. If the field would be negative, I would have the mirror image of this one. And this part will be here. I would be here then. And I would end up there. So after I've turned it off, I go back again. After I turn off, I am either here or there. But in both cases, I'm just stable there. So I can just read off the magnet. Does it have magnetization up or does it have magnetization down? That's the question that I can read off. And it will, in these stable final states, it will stay there for a long time. This time will be exponential n in the model. So this is very long. This result is stable, and I can read it off, or I cannot even read it off when I feel that I have no time. But for the dynamics of the measurement, it doesn't matter whether or not I read it off. Now, I gave you this dynamics of the average magnetization as function of time, how it would go. But that's not really what happens, because quantum mechanics also induces a widening of the distribution. So at initial time, I have a sharp peak, and at final time, I have a sharp peak. But intermediate times, I have a wide distribution. we have solved all of that, and here you see some plots how this goes as function of time. You see it's both the peak shifts, but it also becomes broader. Here it is, for instance, very broad already, and so on. But anyhow, at finite times, then all this weight between zero and almost here becomes very small, and all the weight will be sitting again at the final around the final magnetization. So finally, there's a sharp peak, which is plus mf if the tested spin was up, and it will be at minus nf if mf if the tested spin was down. So we have done the measurement. That's a good point. And now we have to look what we get after the measurement. So the magnet will end up in the up or down ferromagnetic state. And the sign of this magnetization is maximally correlated with the sign of the spin. And the probabilities by which the magnet ends up in the up or down ferromagnetic state are those of the Born rule, because I showed already that these probabilities were conserved in time. And there will be no Schrödinger cat terms. So in a formula that looks like this, no Schrödinger cat terms means that there are only up-up terms and down-down terms for the tested spin. There are no up-down or down-up terms. There's no Schrödinger cat terms. The maximal correlation is that when this is up, then the magnetization of the apparatus is up. And when this is down, then the magnetization of the apparatus is down. And these probabilities by which they occur are those of the Born rule. So that's all very nice. And that brings me already to the quantum measurement problem. How can I look at that from this approach? And here is something which, of course, is a rather simple argument. So if we forget about this, that we do a measurement, if you just look at the apparatus itself, well, this is well understood. I've been teaching course of thermal physics to teach that to the students. You have an initial paramagnet, but it will relax to a ferromagnet because that's a stable state. And this will be up or down, and this will happen randomly. But if you look at the ensemble that describes this, then you have a breaking of ergodicity in your ensemble because you have these two stable thermodynamic states. So each of these states is stable. And you do not jump between them because the Poincaré time is very large. So this is just the breaking of ergodicity, which is described in many books on statistical physics. So this magnet by itself, it will end up anyhow in the up or down ferromagnetic state. And we know very well that this is a long-lived state, and this would describe very good what things that go on in daily life. Now, if you use this magnet over here in a quantum measurement, as I did in the model, then this transition from the paramagnet to this either up or down ferromagnet, it is triggered by this tested spin, and it was because this field, maybe I wrote it there. No, I didn't. I can write it again. This field would be, oh, it's written here. The field that acts on the magnet is G times the sine of the spin. So this transition is triggered by the tested spin. But triggered or not, in the end, the magnet will speak, because that's the microscopic system. It will end up in a ferromagnetic state, and that state has a long lifetime. And this long lifetime, it means uniqueness for the magnet itself, but then also uniqueness for the spin, because the spin was correlated to it. So the magnet will go to either up or down magnetization, finally. And the tested spin, well, that was fully correlated with it, so that is doing the same. It will be either plus or minus. And this will be a stable situation that I can read off case by case. My ensemble describes them with probabilities, and the density matrix describes it with the proper probabilities, but there is also the time argument. There is more, there's this knowledge of what the process is doing, what it is means in reality, which you do not see directly in the density matrix itself, but you know this nevertheless. And when you take into account, you see that you are describing individual measurements, as you would already do in statistical physics of the magnet alone. You would not need to, if you just forget about doing the quantum measurement, already in the statistical physics of the magnet alone, you know that you are describing individual stable states, because the Sprenger array time is very large. It's the breaking of ergodicity that is the subject of many books in statistical physics. Now, this view, which is of course rather intuitive, could be spoiled, but it is not spoiled. It could be spoiled if there were troubles with the Schrödinger cat terms, but there are not. I have shown that they just they do what they should do, namely go away with them. So then, if you wish that after the measurements you can select individual outcomes with magnetization up, you can do that. And that's possible because this ferromagnetic state is long-lived. And if then you have a sub-ensemble of these pure states with spin up, and this sub-ensemble is unambiguous. I have split up some mixed states in an unambiguous sub-ensemble of up and down states. And I could do this because I was using this apparatus which did this unambiguous selection for me. So, here I come to the summary about elucidating this quantum measurement problem. The collapse basis is determined by the interaction Hamiltonian. This was already to be expected. People in the last decades have already understood this. Last decade, say two or three, but not four, certainly not four. The measurement goes in two steps. These Schrödinger cat terms, they die very fast. And while they die, they build up small multi-particle correlations, many, many particle correlations. But all of this goes to zero rather quickly. And then there's a registration of the result. It is slower. And this is also the second step of the measurement dynamics. It has some classical features because this magnetization is going from zero to plus or minus this ferromagnetic value. That is more or less what was anticipated by Bohr, who thought that you should have a classical apparatus. But it's not really correct because you also had a widening of the peak of the distribution, which is really a quantum effect. Nevertheless, we have a macroscopic pointer. So not only the apparatus should be macroscopic, but in particular the pointer should be macroscopic, and therefore it has irreversible dynamics and there's entropy increase. I did not speak about entropy, but you can look at all this entropy playing a role here. And of course, there's an entropy increase when you have this transition from a metastable state to a stable state. You do recover the Born rule, at least in this model of an ideal measurement, you do recover it. And if you build in non-idealities, you can see what they all do and how strong their effects are. The observation of the pointer is irrelevant for the outcomes of the dynamics. So this goes against weakness-friend idea. And it's not needed. It is the dynamics of the system with the apparatus that is doing it all. And whether or not we look afterwards to it doesn't influence the story. The results may be read off or processed automatically, as you often do in experiments, or do nothing with them is also possible. It has happened anyhow by the physical interaction between the system and the apparatus. And this whole approach becomes very simple within the statistical interpretation of quantum mechanics. I'm not, certainly not saying that you cannot have another interpretation, but it becomes rather simple in this one. And the individual outcomes of the measurements are due to the irreversible phase transition in the magnet, combined with the long lifetime of the pointer indication and the fact that the Schrödinger cat terms disappeared at short times because of other properties of the measurement process. So I would like to thank you for your attention.
Yeah, sure. So in the first bullet point, collapse basis determined by interaction Hamiltonian.
Yeah.
How do you know that you haven't replaced the chicken with the egg or the egg with the chicken? Just pedagogically, the way you presented it, you first showed us the collapse basis. And then second to that, you constructed a Hamiltonian that seemed to have something to do with it.
Oh, did I?
That's what it looks like.
Oh, maybe I did. This is not what I do with the papers. First, you find the Hamiltonian, and then I look what is the dynamics of the Hamiltonian.
I mean, I'm doing it in a silly way, but this is
not a kind of
genuine question, which is, you have a target, and you create a Hamiltonian that gets you to the target.
Yeah.
And so it seems that one could interpret all of the work exactly from the opposite point of view, that the target is the collapse basis. And then you invent, or you range your mind over the set of all possible Hamiltonians to say, oh, here's one that fits the basis that I already understood.
I try to think in simple terms, and mostly along lines of people who say want to do a measurement. So I want to measure the spin 1/2, and in this case it seems very logical to do that with a magnet. So now we can speak about the basis of this interaction Hamiltonian. You can ask, for instance, why do I choose this linear interaction Fi with sigma i's of the sigma n's of the apparatus. But this seems, you always have spin-spin interactions, it seems so logical to do. Of course, there are many other models or many other measurements you can do. Of course, our aim was only to find the simplest model and to get somewhere after a literature which had been exploding without clear results. We just wanted to do it our own way, and that was this way. Actually, it was the second model we did. We had the Bose model before, but this is more clumsy. But maybe I did not get your real point.
That's okay.
It's okay.
Well, I have a question similar to that. If the collapse basis is determined by the interaction Hamiltonian, then can I not engineer one to make the cat dead plus alive or dead minus alive? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's, I'm quite confused about that. It seems to me that it sounds like you could choose any collapse basis you want, in particular ones that correspond to cats half dead, half alive, or whatever you want to call it.
Interesting point.
So what stops that, if anything?
Yeah, I try to go there to the formulas. The answer is no. There will always be a basis. And on that basis, here I have it already, of course. Here, I have here the assets. Now suppose I have the Sx there.
Yeah.
No, then it would happen on the Sx basis.
Yeah, but so then I'm going to see a dead and alive cat.
No. The same thing would happen, but then on that basis.
But I thought that's the whole point, is that there's a nice basis where the cat is either alive or dead, but there's a crazy basis where it's half dead and half alive, or dead minus alive, or whatever.
Now you're speaking about competing approaches on the problem. And we know there's a whole literature, and we find it very confusing. So what I have here is the difference of eigenvalues on the basis. And if I would have another basis, let's say Sx, then I would also have the difference of the eigenvalues on that basis. And on the new basis then, also the diagonal terms would be conserved. And the off-diagonal terms would have some dynamics, and they would, but they would do the same dynamics on that basis.
But basis doesn't make sense. There's some bases that don't make any sense classically. That's the problem, I think, if I understand that. Like, you've engineered it to give something that makes sense.
What
if you engineer it to give something that doesn't make any sense?
What I have in mind feels having a magnet and having it either this way or that way or this way. What I have in mind is very practical.
Well, and what I have in mind is very impractical, which is what I'm asking. I'm not disputing you can do this. The question is, why can't you do anything else?
No. What I want to bring forward is a certain approach that is based on models, based on very precise calculations, and we have 130 pages on that. And review of literature and so on. A very precise model which shows the steps one by one and so on. Now, if you want then to come with a different approach to me and ask what about this, then I would have to study and have a look. For instance, you may want the apparatus to start in a pure state. And I would not want that because I would not know how the experimentalists ever do that. They would not do this. They would turn on the apparatus and then drink coffee, let it stabilize.
Well, I don't drink coffee. So.
Well, you're an experimentalist.
No, I'm not.
Well,
that doesn't matter.
This is colloquial talk for letting it stabilize.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so let me ask it differently. Yeah. You've got these. I don't see how it solves that problem, but here's another. So you have these off-diagonal terms, but they die out over some time scale. But that means then they are observable if I look fast enough, does it not?
Yes.
So there are Schrodinger cats, so to speak, or mixed cats.
Well, they started at time zero. So they were there at time zero.
Yeah.
And you could measure them by turning turning the apparatus and measure them instead of the Z components. You could do that. Now the question, what happens? So they have some dynamics and basically they get blurred. So first they get blurred by the magnets and later even by the bath, which is much bigger and completely blurred. Now you ask, how could I measure that? Well, we could in principle stop this dynamics after a time that you tell me, and then put a new apparatus to measure the state which is there, or at least measure properties of this state one by one. This could all be done and it should all come out. You're right in that. And it's a good point that...
So you actually can see these strange states, even if I accept this basis, if provided I do things quickly enough.
If it is stopped quick enough, I have in particular, this Schrodinger cat story, it is on short time scales, but the magnetization has not done anything. It is still where it was, it's still a paramagnetic value. And I have now a change of the initial state, and I could just stop this and use this as a new input for that I want to measure that state with the new apparatus. And then we should be able to measure all this stuff, even this many particle correlations should be measurable. Which I had a little bit further. These many particle correlations, so t to the k, so suppose I want to measure four particle correlations, four of these terms here and with that stuff, I would have t to the 4 here times this. And now you tell me I will turn this off after t, which has a certain value. And so initially, this changing this value, it will grow with t to the k, and later it will decay by the exponent. And these are all things that should be measurable by putting another measurement.
Yeah.
And this is one of the things we would like, that people, we have been thinking, maybe with both Einstein condensates you could do things, but it seems not that it will be easy to do it, because then you need basically two condensates, one which you call apparatus and the other, and what you actually get is some other dynamics, which is quite interesting, and Lalaway has many
papers on that, and the French, the Paris group, many measurements. Actually, quite interesting stuff. But this goes beyond the question I want to address here.
Okay, I suggest that we conclude here the formal part of the seminar, and who is interested in continuing the discussion, remain. So let's thank Theo again.